Imagine a world where a woman's rage could summon the gods themselves to her aid, not to stop her from committing the most unthinkable act, but to help her escape its consequences. This is the shocking reality of Euripides' Medea, a play that continues to disturb and fascinate audiences 2,500 years after its creation. When first performed in 431 BCE, this tale of infanticide was so disturbing that it placed last in Athens' prestigious City Dionysia Festival. Yet today, Medea stands as one of the most frequently performed Greek tragedies, with productions starring luminaries from Maria Callas to Diana Rigg. Even Beyoncé referenced the vengeful sorceress in her album Lemonade, showing how this ancient tale of betrayal and revenge continues to resonate in our contemporary discussions of gender, power, and justice. What makes this play so enduringly powerful? Perhaps it's because Euripides forces us to confront the most uncomfortable question of all. What happens when our sympathies are manipulated to align with someone who commits the most heinous crime imaginable? Euripides emerged as a revolutionary dramatic voice during Athens' golden age, consistently challenging the very foundations of Athenian society through his provocative works. Born around 480 BCE, his life spanned nearly the entire 5th century, a period of extraordinary transformation in Greek civilization marked by unprecedented military victories, cultural achievements, and ultimately devastating conflict. While his contemporaries Sophocles and Aeschylus enjoyed greater success during their lifetimes, Euripides' willingness to question social conventions and portray complex, morally ambiguous characters has made him perhaps the most modern feeling of the ancient tragedians, earning him the title the philosopher of the stage. The comic playwright Aristophanes frequently lampooned Euripides as a dangerous radical, a decadent modernist who followed the relativistic teachings of the sophists, questioned the gods, and created fallen women and ruined heroes. In plays like The Frogs, Aristophanes portrays Euripides as the embodiment of Athens' generational divide, corrupting youth with his subversive ideas about traditional values, religion, and social hierarchy. While exaggerated for comic effect, these criticisms contain kernels of truth. Euripides did indeed democratize tragedy by introducing more realistic and lower-class characters than his predecessors, including slaves, nurses, and common soldiers whose perspectives had rarely been represented on stage. His work shows clear influence from the sophisticated rhetorical techniques taught by the sophists, featuring extended debates and speeches that questioned conventional wisdom about justice, morality, and divine authority. While his contemporaries Sophocles and Aeschylus enjoyed greater success during their lifetimes, Euripides' willingness to question social conventions and portray complex, morally ambiguous characters has made him perhaps the most modern feeling of the ancient tragedians, earning him the title the philosopher of the stage. The comic playwright Aristophanes frequently lampooned Euripides as a dangerous radical, a decadent modernist who followed the relativistic teachings of the sophists, questioned the gods, and created fallen women and ruined heroes. In plays like The Frogs, Aristophanes portrays Euripides as the embodiment of Athens' generational divide, corrupting youth with his subversive ideas about traditional values, religion, and social hierarchy. While exaggerated for comic effect, these criticisms contain kernels of truth. Euripides did indeed democratize tragedy by introducing more realistic and lower-class characters than his predecessors, including slaves, nurses, and common soldiers whose perspectives had rarely been represented on stage. His work shows clear influence from the sophisticated rhetorical techniques taught by the sophists, featuring extended debates and speeches that questioned conventional wisdom about justice, morality, and divine authority. What makes Euripides particularly fascinating is his historical context and prescient social commentary. Medea was produced in 431 BCE, the exact moment Athens and Sparta began the devastating Peloponnesian War that would eventually destroy Athenian dominance. The play's ferocity and exploration of revenge seems almost prophetic of the violence that would soon engulf Greek civilization. In works like The Trojan Women, he portrayed the brutal aftermath of war from the perspective of its victims, while Athens itself was engaging in similar acts of conquest and subjugation. His Bacchae questioned religious orthodoxy and the limits of rational authority at a time when Athens was experiencing significant spiritual and philosophical upheaval. Euripides' willingness to present a sympathetic barbarian woman who triumphs over a Greek hero in Medea challenged his audience's assumptions about gender, ethnicity, and justice at a time when Athens was increasingly defining itself against others. His female characters, including Medea, Phaedra, and Hecuba, are fully realized individuals who rail against their societal constraints, expressing rage and desire in ways that shocked ancient audiences but resonate powerfully today. This cultural context helps explain why Medea initially received such a cold reception but has found such resonance in our own era of shifting power dynamics and cultural reckonings. Euripides' plays continue to speak to contemporary concerns about gender equality, political power, religious skepticism, and the human costs of war. To understand Medea, we must first recognize how radically different theatrical experience was in ancient Athens compared to today. Rather than commercial entertainment, Greek drama was fundamentally a religious and civic ritual performed primarily during the annual City Dionysia Festival honoring the god Dionysus in late March. This festival represented the pinnacle of Athenian cultural and religious life, drawing visitors from across the Greek world and transforming the entire city into a sacred performance space. The festival's competitive nature cannot be overstated. Well before each Dionysia, poets would apply for a chorus to the Archon, a high civic official, who selected participants based on criteria that remain mysterious to us. The selection process involved complex political and religious considerations, with wealthy citizens often serving as chorogai, financial sponsors who funded the course's training and costumes. Simply receiving a chorus was a significant achievement in this intensely agonistic society, where artistic competition mirrored the military and athletic contests that defined Greek culture. During the week-long festival, Athens transformed into a spectacular civic pageant. The celebrations began with a grand procession carrying the statue of Dionysus from his temple to the theater, followed by displays of tribute from Athens' allied cities, ceremonies honoring war orphans, and athletic competitions. Each day of dramatic performances began before sunrise with purification rituals and continued into late afternoon, with audiences watching three tragedies and a satyr play by a single playwright, a demanding schedule that could last up to 15 hours. The physical experience of attending was equally distinct from modern theater. Performances took place in the open-air Theater of Dionysus on the south slope of the Acropolis, where up to 17,000 spectators gathered on stone seats arranged in a steep semicircle. The architecture itself reinforced social hierarchies, with the front rows reserved for priests, officials, and honored guests. Only three actors performed all speaking roles, regardless of how many characters appeared, using simple masks and costume changes to distinguish characters. These masks, with their exaggerated features and expressions, allowed emotions to be visible even to the furthest spectators, while also emphasizing the universal rather than individual nature of the characters. A chorus of 15 men sang and danced in the orchestra, the circular space between the stage and audience, providing commentary, background, and emotional responses to the action. Their complex choreography and choral odes created a rhythmic and musical dimension that modern productions can only approximate. After all performances concluded, 10 judges selected by lot would cast their votes for the winners. The selection of judges by lot reflected Athens' democratic ideals, though the process was carefully managed to prevent corruption. The victorious poet received an ivy crown and led a triumphal procession through Athens, a celebration Euripides rarely experienced despite entering the competition at least 22 times. He won first place only three times during his lifetime, plus once posthumously. This context makes Medea's last place finish in 431 BCE particularly noteworthy, especially given the play's subsequent influence and reputation. What about this play so disturbed its original audience that they ranked it below its now-forgotten competitors? The answer likely lies in how radically Euripides challenged conventional religious and moral assumptions about divine justice and human nature. Euripides' genius in Medea lies not in inventing a new story, but in radically transforming a familiar folktale. The basic outline would have been well known to his audience. An exotic princess helps a hero, follows him home, and is eventually abandoned. However, Euripides makes several crucial modifications that transform this simple tale into a complex psychological drama. First, he ages the relationship. Rather than showing the initial romance, Euripides presents Medea and Jason after 10 years of marriage with two children. This creates a deeper betrayal. Jason isn't abandoning a recent conquest, but a woman who has sacrificed everything for him and borne his children. Second, he presents Jason not as an innocent hero, but as a calculating opportunist who discards Medea for political advancement through marriage to a princess. Finally, and most shockingly, Euripides appears to have invented Medea's deliberate murder of her own children, the element that has made the play so enduringly disturbing. This innovation represents a masterful manipulation of audience sympathies. The play begins by establishing Medea's suffering and Jason's perfidy so thoroughly that we initially identify with her rage. The nurse opens the play lamenting how Medea has been scorned and wronged by Jason, who has betrayed his own children and my mistress. When Medea first appears, she articulates the plight of all women in patriarchal society. Of all things that have life and sense, we women are the most miserable creatures. First, we must buy a husband at high cost and take a master over our bodies. This evil is more galling than the first. The outcome is all important. Will we take a good man or a bad? For divorce brings shame to women, and we can't just say no to a man. This feminist critique would have been shocking to an Athenian audience, yet Euripides makes it impossible to dismiss. By the time Medea begins contemplating infanticide, we've been positioned to understand her rage, making her eventual action all the more horrifying because we've been complicit in sympathizing with her. This psychological complexity transforms what could have been a simple moral tale into a profound exploration of justice, revenge, and the limits of our sympathy. At its core, Medea explores what happens when someone is fundamentally excluded from society's power structures, yet possesses extraordinary abilities. Medea faces a double marginalization, as a woman in patriarchal Athens and as a barbarian, non-Greek, in xenophobic Greek society. When Jason abandons her for a politically advantageous marriage to a Greek princess, he assumes Medea has no recourse. Divorce brought profound shame to women who had virtually no legal rights. What Jason fatally underestimates is Medea's refusal to accept this powerlessness. Early in the play, she delivers a chilling warning. A woman, in other ways, is full of fear, defenseless, dreads the sight of cold steel. But when she is injured in love, no mind is more murderous than hers. This statement serves as both feminist manifesto and ominous foreshadowing. Unlike most women of her time, Medea possesses both supernatural powers as a sorceress and extraordinary intelligence, which she uses to devastating effect. The play repeatedly emphasizes Medea's foreignness, with characters referring to her as the Colchian woman and attributing her passionate nature to her barbarian origins. Yet Euripides complicates this ethnic stereotype by making Medea more articulate than any Greek character in the play. Her rhetorical brilliance is displayed in her confrontation with Creon, where she persuades him to grant her one more day in Corinth, which proves fatal for him, and in her debate with Jason, where she systematically dismantles his self-serving justifications. This tension between Medea's marginalized status and her exceptional abilities creates the play's central dynamic. When conventional paths to justice are closed to her, she creates her own justice system, one that operates outside Greek social norms and ultimately receives divine sanction when her grandfather, the sun god Helios, provides her with an escape chariot. This divine intervention raises disturbing questions about the relationship between human and divine justice. Do the gods care more about broken oaths, Jason's betrayal, than about murdered children? The play offers no comfortable answers. What makes Medea particularly powerful is not just the horrific nature of its protagonist's revenge, but the excruciatingly detailed portrayal of her psychological struggle. Rather than presenting a one-dimensional monster, Euripides shows Medea wrestling with her decision to kill her children in one of literature's most profound explorations of revenge psychology. In her famous monologue, Medea's internal conflict reaches its climax as she vacillates between maternal love and vengeful rage. "Oh, my heart, don't do this deed. Oh, miserable me, let them go, spare the children. Living there with me, they will give you joy. No, by the avenging furies in hell, I will never leave my children for my enemies to abuse. They must die in any case, and since they must, I, who gave them birth, will kill them." This speech reveals the twisted logic of revenge. Medea convinces herself that killing her children is actually protecting them from a worse fate at the hands of her enemies. More profoundly, it shows how revenge consumes not just its target, but its perpetrator. To hurt Jason most effectively, Medea must destroy what she herself loves most. The Greek concept of thymos, passionate spirit, is central to understanding Medea's psychology. She repeatedly acknowledges that her thymos is driving her toward an action her rational mind recognizes as horrific. "I understand what evil I am about to do, but my thymos is stronger than my reasoned thoughts." This is not simple madness, but a complex psychological state where emotion overwhelms reason while remaining fully conscious of the moral implications. What's particularly disturbing is that Medea's revenge succeeds perfectly on its own terms. She states explicitly that her goal is to ensure Jason lives on, childless and in pain. "I want him to live, to wander through life a broken man." By the play's end, Jason has lost his new bride, his royal future, his sons, and even their bodies, which Medea refuses to let him bury. Her revenge is total, leaving him to die eventually struck by a rotting fragment of the Argo, an unheroic end that completes his transformation from mythic hero to pathetic victim. The chorus in Medea serves as both a representative of conventional Corinthian society and as the audience's emotional surrogate. Composed of Corinthian women, they initially sympathize with Medea's plight as an abandoned wife, creating a sense of female solidarity that crosses ethnic boundaries. "I heard the voice, I heard the cry of the unhappy woman from Colchis," they sing, responding to Medea's offstage wails of grief. This sympathy, however, has clear limits. When Medea reveals her plan to murder the royal family, the chorus expresses shock but does not intervene, perhaps because they share her sense that Jason has committed a grave injustice. But when she announces her intention to kill her children, they make a desperate attempt to dissuade her. "Since you have shared your plan with us, wanting to help you and uphold human laws, I forbid you to do this." This moment reveals the chorus's fundamental helplessness. Despite their moral clarity, they lack the power to stop Medea. Their role becomes increasingly that of witnesses to horror, processing the unfolding tragedy through song and lamentation. As Medea commits her crimes offstage, the chorus provides the emotional response that the audience itself might feel. O Earth, O radiant light of the sun, look, look down on this ruined woman, before she strikes with murderous hand, blood-stained against her children. For they have sprung from your golden race, and it is terrible for mortal blood to be spilled by men to the ground. O light-born God, restrain her, stop her, drive this blood-guilty fury from this house. Their appeal to divine intervention goes unanswered, or worse, is answered in reverse when the sun god provides Medea with her escape chariot. This divine sanction of Medea's actions creates profound theological discomfort, suggesting a disconnect between human and divine moral systems. The chorus's final words acknowledge this disturbing reality. Zeus on Olympus enforces all things. The gods can accomplish what no one would hope for. What we expect may not happen at all, while the gods find a way, against all expectation, to do what they want, however surprising. While Medea dominates the play, Jason's character provides a fascinating study in self-deception and moral blindness. Once the glorious hero who captured the Golden Fleece, he appears in this play as a calculating opportunist who has convinced himself that his betrayal is actually beneficial for everyone involved. When Jason first appears, he attempts to reframe his abandonment of Medea as reasonable pragmatism rather than betrayal. His marriage to the princess, he claims, will secure his position in Corinth and provide financial security for his sons. I did not make this royal marriage because I was tired of your bed, but with the best intentions, so that we might live well. This self-serving rationalization reveals Jason's fundamental flaw, his inability to recognize emotional realities beyond practical considerations. Jason's moral bankruptcy becomes even clearer when he suggests that Medea should actually be grateful for his actions. You should not let jealousy consume you, nor be angry that I've made a better arrangement. You ought to be happy, not jealous. This breathtaking lack of empathy shows why Medea's revenge proves so effective. Jason simply cannot imagine that his actions have consequences beyond his calculated plans. The tragedy of Jason is that he recognizes his error only when it's far too late. After Medea has killed their children, he finally acknowledges what she had been telling him all along. Now I understand, but I did not then. His final appearance, begging merely to touch his children's bodies and being denied even this comfort, completes his transformation from hero to pathetic victim. His last words reveal complete despair. Zeus, do you hear how I am driven away? What I suffer from this hateful child-killing lioness? What makes Jason's character so compelling is that while he is clearly morally culpable, he is not a simple villain. His fatal flaw is a particularly masculine form of rationality that dismisses emotional bonds as irrational and fails to recognize that betrayal cannot be justified by practical benefits. In many ways, he represents the limitations of the Greek male perspective that dominated Athenian society, making Medea's triumph over him all the more subversive. The most disturbing aspect of Medea may be its theological implications. Throughout Greek tragedy, we expect to see divine justice punish those who transgress moral boundaries. Yet Medea presents us with the opposite. A woman who commits infanticide is rewarded with divine assistance rather than punishment. This paradox is embodied in the play's extraordinary final scene. After murdering her children, Medea appears above the stage in a flying chariot sent by her grandfather, the sun god Helios. From this literally elevated position, typically reserved for gods in Greek tragedy, she taunts Jason while preventing him from touching his children's bodies. This Deus ex machina, God from the machine, conclusion inverts the usual function of divine intervention. Rather than restoring moral order, it sanctions Medea's vengeance. Why would the gods support such horrific actions? The play suggests that divine justice operates according to different principles than human morality. Throughout the play, characters invoke Zeus as guardian of oaths, emphasizing the sacred nature of the marriage vows Jason has broken. In the divine economy of justice, Jason's betrayal of these sacred bonds apparently outweighs even the murder of children. This theological perspective creates profound discomfort. If the gods themselves sanction such extreme vengeance, what moral framework can humans rely on? The chorus's final words acknowledge this troubling reality. The gods accomplish many things against our expectation. What we thought would happen does not come to pass, while the god finds a way to bring about the unexpected. This ambiguous conclusion refuses to provide moral closure. Medea is neither clearly condemned nor vindicated. Instead, Euripides leaves his audience with disturbing questions about the nature of justice itself. Is Medea's revenge justified by Jason's betrayal? Does divine sanction make her actions right? The play offers no simple answers, forcing each generation of viewers to wrestle anew with these fundamental ethical dilemmas. 25 centuries after its creation, Medea continues to shock, disturb, and fascinate audiences worldwide. Its enduring power stems from Euripides' refusal to provide simple moral judgments or comfortable resolutions. Instead, the play forces us to confront the most disturbing aspects of human experience: betrayal, rage, revenge, and the destruction of what we most love. What makes Medea particularly relevant to contemporary audiences is its exploration of marginalized identity and power. Medea's status as both woman and foreigner in Greek society creates her initial powerlessness, yet she refuses to accept the limitations imposed on her. Her famous declaration, "I would rather stand three times in battle array than give birth once," acknowledges the unique suffering of women while asserting her refusal to be defined by it. This complex portrayal of gender dynamics continues to resonate in our ongoing discussions about power, justice, and revenge. The play also raises uncomfortable questions about our own complicity as audience members. Euripides' brilliant manipulation of sympathies means we initially align ourselves with Medea's righteous anger, only to find ourselves horrified by where that anger leads. This forces us to examine our own capacity for vengeful thinking and the potentially destructive consequences of justified rage. Perhaps most disturbingly, Medea suggests that conventional justice systems may fail those most marginalized by society. When Medea declares, "No one shall think me submissive or weak, nor quiet in spirit," she rejects the passive suffering expected of women in favor of active vengeance. Her triumph, however morally repugnant, represents a refusal to accept victimhood. This complex portrayal of vengeance as simultaneously horrific and empowering continues to challenge our understanding of justice itself. The final image of Medea escaping in her divine chariot beyond human justice, yet carrying the burden of her own actions, remains one of literature's most ambiguous and powerful conclusions. Neither completely villain nor victim, Medea embodies the complexity of human experience in a world where justice is uncertain and the gods themselves seem to sanction our most destructive impulses. In forcing us to confront these uncomfortable realities, Euripides created a work that continues to disturb and enlighten audiences across millennia, a testament to tragedy's enduring power to make us question our deepest assumptions about justice, revenge, and the human capacity for both suffering and inflicting pain.